Hello and welcome to the latest edition of University Registrars Talking About Stuff, this time with the opportunity to hear from Douglas Blackstock, Chief Executive of the Quality Assurance Agency for Higher Education. We learn all about the work of the QAA and how it's shrunk significantly in size in recent years, but remains an organisation with global reach and one which is still complex in terms of its operations, dealing with hundreds of institutions in the UK and many similar agencies overseas too. QAA operates as a UK-wide organisation, and while there may be policy divergence, the quality code remains UK-wide, and the agency sustains important relationships with funding bodies in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. The international perspective is significant and valuable, as there is real respect for the UK higher education brand overseas, but also a desire to learn from the British experience, and overseas agencies will often look at QAA reports for the authoritative view of the quality of UK provision. We also discuss the QAA's key relationship and works with professional statutory and regulatory bodies, which is really important to the sector, particularly during the pandemic, and look at how it relates to other parts of the regulatory landscape too. COVID has had a significant impact on the work of the agency. Although many staff were already working remotely because they tend to spend a lot of time on the road, the organisation had to adapt quickly to the new challenges to help people with working from home, for example. There are undoubtedly opportunities for different working approaches in future, especially given the previous requirements for significant international travel for staff, leading to savings in time and money. Douglas applauds the effort of all staff and students in universities in supporting the response to the pandemic, noting in particular the extent of student volunteering and the work of students' unions. Having bumped into each other in a number of roles over the years, Douglas reminds me that I advised him many years ago not to go and work for the QAA, as it wouldn't be around for very long. I could not have been more mistaken, and we hear about his time at the agency following a journey which took him from a late starting student in Glasgow to student union officer in sabbatical, and then working in student unions before joining the QAA. He ended up staying and developing his career there, and then found himself as acting chief executive before being confirmed in the position, and all sees all of this as fundamentally confirming the value of higher education. He wouldn't have got to where he is now without it. With retirement now in sight for Douglas, this really is a great run through the work of QAA and his part in it. I do hope you enjoy it. Welcome then to another edition of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. And this time it's my enormous pleasure to introduce Douglas Blackstock, who is Chief Executive of the Quality Assurance Agency for Higher Education. Welcome, Douglas. Now, you're not technically a registrar, right? But, you know, you're someone senior in the sector who knows loads of stuff. So it seemed, entirely appropriate that you and I have a conversation, and you were, you know, willing to do so, which is the other key criterion here. Did I get the title right, by the way? It's Chief Executive.
It is.
Right. And how big is the empire, right? How big actually is the QAA? Because I must admit, only having a hazy notion of its size.
Sure. Look, QAA is a small organisation, and it's got smaller in the last 3 years. Unfortunately, I've had to make 60%, so that's 60% of our staff redundant as a result of changes in, largely driven in England, by the changes by HEFCA, then later the Higher Education Research Act. So we're a small organisation, but we have a global reach and an extensive set of relationships. The interesting thing is, in the conversations we have, is that we're smaller, but what we do is no less complex, and the scale of it is still is significant. We're doing a lot less units of review, but a lot more of relationship and enhancement support and that type of activity. So but relationships with in the UK across maybe 500 institutions of various sizes and types, of which 275 are voluntary members. And then a broad international reach, relationships with around 20, formal relationships with around 20 bodies of our equivalent, and then a range of other organisations. And then, as well as the sector, individual sector relationships, there's relationships with the representative bodies, governments, and et cetera as well.
I'll come on to all of those things in a moment. And I'm interested in the kind of national versus, you know, the UK-wide remit and the local national remits. And you suggested there are a lot of the difficult things you've had to do recently have been very much driven by the Higher Education Research Act, which does only apply to England. How does that play out in practice? I mean, are the Scots not a bit sceptical of you?
No, I think our relationships and the support for QE in Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland is as strong as it's ever been. And you're part of the change process in QE is a very clear organisational change and policy change and culture we developed of ensuring that the perspectives and the needs of the four nations have equal play, equal part. You know, we have board members from Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland on a board. We have a Scotland committee, a Wales committee, and we have distinctive and individual relationships with the Scottish Funding Council, Higher Education Funding Council for Wales and the Department for the Economy in Northern Ireland, as well as the University of Scotland, Universities of Wales, etc. And so in a management structure, we have a director who is essentially responsible for the devolved nations, but also he deals with our European policy, because actually it's really important that that's not driven just by England. England's is an important and largest part of the sector, but we are very much a UK organisation, but does distinctive things in each of the four nations.
Yeah, so you are able to manage with what feels like a kind of continuing divergence in terms of higher education policy. It's not unmanageable, clearly.
Well, look, policy is diverging, but there are unifying factors, and one of the unifying factors is the UK Quality Code. And the desire for the maintenance of the UK brand. There are aspects of higher education where institutions deal with UK-wide government departments, Department for International Trade, Foreign Commonwealth Development Office, the Home Office, your friends in the Home Office, base. So actually there is still a UK infrastructure, but there's distinctive needs in the nations.
Yeah.
But if you look at higher education policy, we started mapping this out about 2 or 3 years ago. We did an internal briefing document around it about a shift to join up in tertiary education policy. It's got slightly different hues, but in all the same direction of travel, skills, progression, new types of qualifications. The policy intents are maybe driven from different political perspectives, but the direction of travel is very similar.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. What about the, going back to, I mean, you talked about relationships, and you've talked a number of times already about relationships with different arms of government, etc. I mean, it doesn't seem to me, it wasn't that long ago, and we're talking about, kind of a decade, which is a long time in UK higher education, of course, where things were a lot simpler. In terms of, the structuring of the UK higher education regulatory landscape, and kind of, it was clear what QAA did. It was about the quality and standards issues. It was about, the oversight of assurance, et cetera, et cetera. But actually, from everything you've said, it feels it's much more about relationships now with different parts of government and different parts of the regulatory architecture. Is that an oversimplification of things?
It's in part. I mean, the fundamentals are still about standards. Are standards secure and the students getting good quality in terms of learning and teaching opportunities? But it's less in terms of formal compliance review. Much more in terms of, what we, if you take what we do with colleagues in the Office for Students, that's only about a third of the income of QA now. Much more is based on voluntary institutional subscriptions, the enhancement themes in Scotland, the enhancement work in Wales, and our international work. So it is changing, but we were part of the initial drives for the change. In 2009, we shared a paper with the funding councils and with UUK, where we argued there was diminishing marginal returns from repeated cycles of reviews that look at exactly the same thing. we just got told, you know, that's not for you to determine that. And 4 or 5 years later, I think everybody had come on board with us. You know, we've had, I think, apart from far too many different changes to the review methods, I think we've had 5 cycles of audits in the UK since 1992, since the academic audit unit was set up. But you remember all these academic audit unit, HEQAA. And actually some of these discussions are happening in Norway and France and Ireland and the Netherlands, where, you know, in the North and Western Europe, where we've had long established quality arrangements at national level, people are beginning to say, what does all this add up to now? Is there different ways of doing it? The European Association, ENCA, has recently adopted a new strategy, which the third strand is innovation and quality assurance. I mean, that's quite a move. But of course, in international policy terms, and I know I'm drifting a bit here, but we've got 48 countries in the European higher education area. About half of them are fairly new, coming out of the post-Soviet era and developing systems and all that sort of stuff. So there is an aspect of that that's different. I think the other thing that we all have learned and recognised, and I think we have done it well, is that when QAA was created under the John Major government, there wasn't devolution, you know, and under the change of government, the Blair government brought in devolution, and we've all had to learn what that is. I think we're still learning. It's only 20 years, you know, 20 something years. We're all learning what devolution is, whether it's max or minor, and that, you know, we've got real live debates for independence now. So we have adapted and adjusted in a way that we think can suit each nation, but keep the UK brand.
Yeah, no, that's really, really clear, I think. I want to come back to the international element as well, because one of the things there are two elements to this. It's really striking. One is the kind of respect and understanding of the authority of the QAA internationally. And I think that, you know, its ability to, you know, kind of articulate a clear view of the, you know, the assurance arrangements within the UK, which then helps enormously our sector overseas. And I think that real, you know, that real kind of stamp of authority is incredibly important. But the other element to it, which is what you articulated, is the desire from other parts of the world to learn from our experience and see one model for how it might be done. And it does seem to me that that element of it has grown enormously in recent years. Is that the case, or is it just that you kind of talk about it more?
I think it's both. It's been a long process. We've always been well respected, and you know, we're certainly more loved overseas maybe than sometimes in the UK. And you know, we Egypt's quality system is designed on ours. Kuwait's quality system's designed on ours. Hong Kong university system's designed on us. In fact, we manage those audits for the Hong Kong UGC. The European standards and guidelines is fundamentally designed on the UK's academic audit model. Now, we're moving away from that in different respects, haven't we, in recent years? But we've got to be seen to be an innovator. I mean, we've had 3 external reviews of QAA. We get one every 5 years. And in each one of them, they've described us as an international leading authority in the world of quality assurance. So we are highly respected. But we don't do it for a jolly. And one of the things I have changed in terms of how we communicate this is about not being perceived to be out there working in the international field for the greater good of QAA. We're doing it for the reputation of our higher education system, to build trust and confidence. And you know, from the countries where you've got campuses in China and Malaysia, trust and confidence is really, really important. So as an example, and maybe we haven't shouted enough about our work with overseas governments and with our own governments. It's, you know, in the past, when we were all in it together and QAA get big lumps of public funding and institutional subscriptions to do everything, everybody played a part of it, it was sort of didn't really matter. Now we have to persuade you every year to take out a membership fee. Well, you know, you'll know the Chinese Service Center for Scholarly Exchange. They're the body that approves degrees for Chinese students, right? And you can go to you have to go to an approved provider, or you can apply for your degree to be approved on your return. They make their decisions based on published quality assurance reports, and for the UK, that's QAA. right? Yeah. And they want to see published quality assurance reports. In the United Arab Emirates, KHDA, they have a very light touch regulatory regime for overseas campuses based on a published quality assurance report. So there are some issues that are getting quite tricky for us now. Yeah. And and don't get me wrong, we don't need any sympathy, that sort of stuff. But some of the criticisms that were launched at QA around 2014, 2015 caused not just us, but the sector a lot of damage.
Yeah.
And so we have had to up our diplomatic efforts to try and persuade people that there is still a strong and robust and quality system in the UK. It's just evolving and moving in different ways. We've got really good, robust, but lighter touch and different regulation. I think one of the things that's actually helped in the pandemic is that in 1 week in January, I had meetings in 7 different countries, but I didn't have to travel to them.
Yeah.
You know, normally these trips, the visits are very, very time consuming. And as a smaller organisation, it's hard. You know, we can't be everywhere all the time. So we are very well networked in international networks and things like the Asia Pacific Quality Network, the European Network, the American Network CHEER, to try and promote UK higher education. And I don't just mean the TNE. It's the confidence of overseas governments to send their students here as well. It really, really matters.
No, I do think that's hugely important. And I think, I was as guilty as others in not appreciating that a number of years ago. But certainly the impact of the reviews in China and Malaysia on the authority of the reports produced there have, had a profound impact on the confidence of both of those nations in UK higher education. And that, certainly from my own institution's point of view, that was absolutely invaluable for us in terms of, relationships with government, the approval routes, but also student recruitment. It made a genuinely significant difference, and I think that's been enormously helpful. So I do think that element is a really vital aspect of the QAA's work, and it's probably still underappreciated by some, but no longer me.
But as I say, Paul, we don't need sympathy, and we appreciate everybody's money. I mean, let's be honest. It was part of our changes is so we had to put ourselves forward to become the designated body in England, and that was really important. And we got 98% support. That was incredible. The other things we do in England are voluntary, so we've had to become, if you like, a membership body, commercial, show that we can add value and deliver it. What's really hard is that the sector, because of the Bell review, there was a lot of talk of we want products and services. Actually, a lot of what we do is intangible. So the work we've just done with professional statutory regulatory bodies, we're the only organisation with a relationship across all of these organisations. Of course, individual institutions do it, but at a national level, we've a broad range of relationships. We've been able to work with them, bring them together with government, and we've had several roundtables now with the universities minister in England, but also briefings into Kirsty Williams and Richard Lockhead.
And this is part of the COVID response to the assessment situation and brokering that.
But we've been doing it for years. Because one of the things that I guess it was never really gets talked about, you'll remember, back in 2001, you said to me, don't go to QAA, it won't be around much longer on the campus at Warwick.
I'm a visionary.
Yeah, you are, yeah. But one of the parts of the 2001 settlement in ending subject review was the PSRBs were doing program accreditation.
Yeah.
So we've always used their reports as evidence in QAA institutional reports, and they've used QAA institutional level reports and information that we do that, I guess, now with the OFS, in terms of they don't need to look at everything in governance and management institutions. So we've been holding PSRB forums twice a year for nearly 2 decades. Mm-hmm. And we involve the PSRBs on the subject benchmarks. You remember 5-6 years ago, lots of people saying, why do you need subject benchmarks? One of our board members was the chief executive of the Engineering Council. And he said, well, you can take it off the QAA website today, but it'll be on ours tomorrow because we jointly developed that. And so there is something we work with the professional bodies to help them understand the sector, to help the sector understand them. And a lot of what we've been doing in the enhancement space and the guidance space has all been about cooperation, collaboration, bringing people together. And what I would say to you mentioned the quality code earlier, particularly code and the advice and guidance that grounds that, they are the shared expressions of the sector of what good looks like.
Yeah.
And then we, you know, good institutions, but there's lots of institutions want to move beyond that, and we try and facilitate that as well. We work with other sector agencies and that too. So I'm rambling on there now, man.
No, I think it's really important, because I do think that in England, I don't think the DfE immediately realised what a resource it had in terms of that ability to bring the PSRBs together in response to the crisis and to facilitate that roundtable so quickly. And it took them a bit of time to realise. I'm glad they did, because it occurred to me that they were just, you know, struggling to work a way through that. But it was, you know, blindingly obvious.
It'd be nice if they gave us some money to pay for it, but
indeed. But as you say, you're used to living on your wits these days anyway.
The other thing about that, though, what's really important, there's two other aspects of that. Most I think of the professional bodies, the statutory ones anyway, operate UK wide.
Yeah.
So there's the Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland interest. Many of them operate in the Republic of Ireland, and our colleagues in QQI have got an interest on this and this as well. So some of the stuff that we've done around this guidance, we've had QQI involved in, and certainly we meet with them regularly, because there's a shared interest here, because many Irish institutions still have long connections. One of the other things we're involved in is called the Five Countries Group, but it's very low key, very invisible. But it's us, it's Ofqual, it's Qualifications Wales, it's Eston, it's ETI Northern Ireland, SQA, and bringing the bodies together. And we've actually got a leaflet called Qualifications Can Cross Boundaries, because what's really getting harder now for students, for learners, for employers to understand the complexity of qualifications across the UK and the Republic of Ireland.
Yeah. Yeah, and as you said, another important part of the portfolio. What about, I mean, thinking about that wider regulatory landscape, right? And you already joked about me saying, you know, QAA won't exist. And you know, in that period prior to 2001, I was very much in the camp of really actively hoping that the QAA would go away.
You wrote a book about it.
Yeah, and I did write a book about it, and indeed a PhD thesis. But the things have changed, right? And I mean, you know, from my perspective now, the QAA looks like a really valuable anchor in the regulatory landscape. And there's lots of other flotsam and jetsam on the sea, which I would quite happily remove. You know, you are part of that landscape. I'm mixing my metaphors desperately here, right? But you are part of that regulatory landscape and a critical part of it. How do you relate? And it's messy now following the Higher Education Research Act in England. But how do you relate to the other parts of that regulatory landscape and others who see themselves as the, you know, the kind of dominant players in the landscape, and particularly the OFS in England? How does that work for you? I mean, you've got to navigate your own path. But as you say, you've got you know, bigger issues you're trying to deal with as well.
Yeah, but look, it's really important. I mean, I think we're about to publish, we'll publish soon, a 10-year retrospective of our reviews of alternative providers. Next month marks 10 years of Theresa May announcing in Parliament that we were taking on educational oversight. I mean, we'd known for some months that was coming. One of the things I've said in that is that I think we were the first organisation to call for a single register of providers, because we were reviewing providers on a Hefke register, on a Home Office register, and on a BAES DfE register. And it seemed to us this had to be brought together. We argued strongly for the HERA. And indeed, you know, I knew that there was going to be a green paper before most other people. We set out how we think it could work. We advocated for the creation of a designation status for ourselves in HESA, a bit like OIA has, because OIA is designated under as a body for adjudication, and the relationship whether you've got regulation informed by independent quality assurance. And of course, look, OFS is new. Nicholas did a huge job setting up a new organisation, bringing two organisations together. But we've got a formal agreement. We've introduced review methods. We've learned a bit about them. We're learning to work in a different way with a new regulator. They're learning how to implement. And you know, you've seen OFS have consulted on a number of things they think got to change based on their first few years of experience. And we have very good relationships with HESA, who are part of this. We are in, registrars should be interested in this. We're in the M5 group ourselves, HESA and JISC, where we're trying to share services, reduce burden. You know, one of our reorganisation elements is JISC provide our IT now. So the money stays in the sector rather than a private company. We moved out of our London office and we have hot desks in JISC. At JISC use our Glasgow office. So there's a really close cooperation there with sector agencies and people in the landscape. And of course, we keep, though, an independent relationship with the Department for Education, the Department for International Trade, the Foreign Office, because we're doing work on behalf of our members that isn't in the statutory role we have in England, because it's quite narrow. That's quite narrow. It's about conducting assessments. The broader stuff, so we're doing some really good work and one powerful work led by Sue Rigby, the VC at Bath, for us on credit framework, looking at different credit bearing qualifications, which are designed to help the government with economic recovery and the sector to respond. And we're the only body, the best placed body to be able to do that in a way that the sector has a stake in it.
Yeah.
And I mean the HE institutions and the FE colleges, because we've got a lot of FE college members too.
Yeah. You talked a little bit earlier about the kind of one of the side benefits of the pandemic was you were able to travel around the world very quickly in a way that you might not otherwise have been. But how else has, what other impacts has it had on the organisation? It's obviously had profound impacts on universities and their ability to operate and to deliver face-to-face teaching and research, etc. But as an organisation, how has it affected the QAA? Have you adapted naturally to the environment?
Well, look, one of the things is that way back, my equivalent job, my original job in QA was Director of Administration, a grand title that, and then Resources, and Director of Resources, and I was Chief Operating Officer. And so I was responsible for HR, Finance, IT, all that sort of business, and business continuity. So way back in 2003, I think, 2004, we incentivized staff to make sure they had broadband at home. So we created the systems and the extranet and the capacity for people to work at home. And largely because, at least a third of QA staff would be on the road at any one time and working from hotel rooms and, those glorious things of 5 nights away from home. You know, a lot of our staff have had to put up with a lot over a lot of years in terms of inconvenience. And then in 2007, Gloucester got flooded. And our building was closed to us, and we were able to work from home. But what we realised then, quite shortly after that, we stopped buying desktops. We haven't bought desktops for a long time. Everybody has a laptop, and they've been encouraged to take it home at night. And so that we've always built into there's nothing like losing access to your campus for a week. What's interesting about the pandemic, it was a business continuity response for the whole nation, wasn't it? And international, the whole world.
Yeah.
So we were geared up for that and with the protocols and the access and the ways of working. So very quickly, colleagues adapted. But the initial things were, I was sitting and I go to a conference every year in Washington, D.C. And why do I go? Because everybody goes. I had bilaterals with colleagues from China, Hong Kong, Malaysia, Thailand, Jamaica, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates. And so one travel and you get to meet a whole bunch of people. But I was dominant on the news. And you knew by the time we come back, by the time I spoke at, I was a keynote speaker at the African Centres of Excellence conference in Nigeria, 500 academics from across West Africa. And I was getting temperature checked there, and you knew something was coming.
Yeah.
And we took a decision based in, and this was the interesting thing. I met with the minister in the Chinese embassy, who was very grateful for the way universities had responded to support Chinese students during the initial, you know, there was that flurry of unpleasantness.
We
said, well, we'll produce some guidance on TNE if you find that helpful. And that was our first step into guidance. And then we rapidly moved. Part of the problem was because we were still coming out of a restructuring. We only had two people working in the quality and standards space. And so we had to re-divert a whole bunch of people, reconvene the organisation, and put it into two sets of working groups to start working on guidance for the sector. And I know there's been some criticism, and why wouldn't you criticise? But we decided, the biggest thing we decided, we would not produce new rules, that we would produce practice that the sector could recognise and was evolving itself. So we moved in two phases. One was the immediate COVID response on what looks good and what people are doing. And then from April, looking at planning ahead, what's the next academic year look like? Because we realised then there wasn't going to be a normal academic year. Everyone was talking about moving to dual and blended. And we produced a whole suite of resources to help the sector. And some of that was what in the initial period people used to cross-reference what they'd done to give themselves some confidence. Other stuff people used it for their planning. But people had to work at a real pace, long hours. You'll know this. Really adapted, and we had to find spaces to give people breathing space as well. And we've had to do things like home risk assessments. We've even done video risk assessments for people. We've given people a license to buy the bits of kit they need rather than having to go through central procurement. We're probably going to get trouble for that later. But, you know, there are some things that have been extremely positive. You know, I've saved on average 20 hours a week travelling, and that goes for quite a lot of us.
Yeah.
I feel really sorry for the staff who've got school-age kids. Really, you know that. You're familiar with these stories. Really difficult to juggle toddlers and 5 and 7 year olds and do your work.
Yeah.
And so we've tried to build in flexibility. We've had a long process of engagement with staff on what should our new ways of working. And a lot of regulatory activity was suspended. I don't think everybody wanted us turning up on the door, checking up on them when they were in their houses. But we started rolling some stuff back out again by doing virtual reviews. We convened an international partners forum last spring, and we learned, you know, we also listened to other countries, colleagues in other countries, what they were doing. One of the things I argued is that, and still arguing, is that quality assurance should use this opportunity to change. How do we get towards net zero? How do we get to a point where actually we can reduce the cost and the burden by doing things virtually, preparing in advance? There'll be some people you always need to go and visit. So we've been adapting our working practices in ways that we hope will be long-term, will be beneficial.
And I which is fantastic. And I think that mirrors, you know, lots of the experiences in, you know, in institutions as well. And, you know, the response of colleagues to the challenges that have been thrown at them has been, you know, immense, really. I've been, you know, absolutely amazed by the way colleagues have responded. It's been fantastic. But it's been a blooming long haul. And we're not quite out of the woods yet.
Let's just see if I could say, Paul, because that's a really important point, and this is to play back to colleagues in the sector. I don't know how many listen, but I did the keynote address at the Asia Pacific Quality Network and at the UK China Joint Institute Alliance at the Council for Higher Education Accreditation in the States there, and every one of these, I should have said this at the beginning. From me, I would like to thank every member of staff in every institution, academic staff, support staff and students, who've shown enormous determination and adaptability to keep their colleagues safe, their students safe, and move rapidly to, it's not the experience everybody expected. I mean, I've got kids, I know what it's like, right? But not just that, to play the huge part in the public health response. Whether it's students volunteering to take food parcels to other students or people in the community, student unions. I mean, student unions get a hard time. They've done a brilliant job on this in working institutions. And the research into the vaccine, student nurses and academic staff going back into hospitals. It's been a tremendous effort. You wonder why people are giving us a kicking.
Yeah. And we could talk for hours on that. But I completely agree with all that. I think, you know, universities have done extraordinarily well and don't necessarily get the credit we all deserve. But just to wrap up, because we are almost out of time, Biggus. I mean, you've recently announced your retirement, which I can't quite believe yet. But and you know, go back a long way to when we were both students in Scotland. But I mean, when you look back on your are you surprised at your journey to being chief exec of the QAA? Because I must admit, I mean, you know, we had touch points throughout both of our careers over the past 30 years, and I just think, you know, it is, you know, odd and delightful to, you know, to have these connections you know, in our sector. It just seems really surprising to me.
Yeah, well, there was no plan. I did a speech at University of Wolverhampton just before the lockdown. It was a personal journey, and I remember the careers advisor, the 20 minutes I got with a science teacher who said, I'm not giving you a reference for university. People like you shouldn't go to university. And I decided not to go at 16. I went at 17. And I didn't do particularly well. I didn't fit in. I didn't adjust it, and I dropped out. And so I'm forever a statistic of failure. And that's what it felt like for a very long time. And so in a, in a personal journey thing, I had an interview for I'd worked in various places, but I got an interview, and this guy said, I really want to employ you, but I think you should go back to university, because once you've got that degree, nobody can take it away from you. So I did. I turned up. How do you join the students' union? They said, you're a member. And next thing I knew, I was on the executive. 2 years later, I'm the president. And then began a journey of, for reasons you'll remember, standing for election in NUS Scotland. And then I actually realised some of the people who managed students' associations in Scotland were really remarkable. I think particularly Foster Evans at Strathclyde influenced me. And I decided to apply for a job in London and got it, and then moved west and moved to Warwick, where we crossed. I was looking for a change. I think there's a lifetime when you can do students' unions, and I started looking, okay, I'd like to still do things that support students and higher education, but looking at that, and that's when I discovered down the M5, where I lived already, there was a whole bunch of organisations, and I was fortunate that Peter Williams took a gamble and took me on, and in the midst of that, in 2007, when the QAA board, heavily influenced by the practice of the General Medical Council and our colleagues in Scotland, said, we want to put students at the heart of this organisation on the board. We've got a student strategic advisory committee. We want students on the review teams. Who was the obvious candidate to do it? And that's where it went. And then in the midst of a difficult period, the Australian Prime Minister had the good sense to, you know, offer our chief executive a job. The board turned to me and asked me to step in for a period, and then it happened.
Yeah.
And how did that happen? And so I'm in this position where this boy born in a room and kitchen in a tenement without a bathroom or a toilet in the south side of Glasgow is the chief executive of a small but globally influential organisation. Of course, the answer is I went to higher education and got a degree.
Yeah.
And I took a chance to go back again, and other people took a chance in me and supported me. Yeah. And of course, very hard work and being very, very good.
Douglas, that's a fantastic story to wrap things up. And it's been great talking to you. And thank you so much for your time and for engaging with a dialogue all about quality, which is what we both love and enjoy. Thanks ever so much.
Cheers, Paul.
That's all then from University Registrars talking about stuff this time. There'll be plenty more along in due course, and if you can't wait, then please do check out the Registrarism blog on wonky.com, where you'll find lots of higher education comment and fun and games. Until next time.